The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 25, 2021. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. It's really nice to see people in person. Really nice to see people in the Zendo, and we still have our Zoom community joining us as well, and it's certainly great to see you here as well. I do have a special note for you people on Zoom, and that is what we're doing is Zoom right now, the hybrids, having people in person and online is a work in progress, and I'm letting you know that because my understanding is that today we haven't quite figured out how to get questions from you to the speaker yet, so we will be working on that, so please bear with us. So, you know, I was thinking about when we closed the doors to Dharma Field, when the pandemic was really starting to get out of control, and it was shortly before the government actually asked for all buildings to shut down, and it's been 16 months, a little over 16 months. I remember when we shut it down, I was thinking, well, this will last a couple weeks. And then I was, well, this will last a couple months. And I was like, oh, this is going into next year. So it was, it's just all I can say is after all that time, so nice to be back here in this space with all of you. It's nice, as I put, you know, the title of my talk, by the way, is Sangha Ing. So the word Sangha, and then I put an ing at the end of it, Sangha Ing. Because I've been thinking a lot over the last year about what Sangha is. And I'm guessing that all of us have been thinking a bit about what Sangha is. And so I just thought it would be a nice topic to touch on. And one of the things I thought about as far as what Sangha is, and it's a word actually when I started looking at books, just to see what some of the wiser teachers out there have been saying about Sangha, I was surprised to see that the same word that came to my mind popped up in both of theirs. I assume it's probably not an uncommon term, and that's friends. So when I came here this morning, I was thinking it's just nice to see friends again. And, you know, as I wrote that, I thought, well, of course, friends in person. You know, I've certainly been seeing friends online. But seeing friends in person again has been nice. And I thought, well, you know, actually it's been happening in my social life, right? I've been seeing more people again. My social calendar is actually starting to fill up. Before, my life was so predictable. I could tell you what I was going to do on a Thursday evening, and I could even tell you at what time I'd be doing certain things. It got that predictable. And now, people are coming into my life again, and I'm visiting people, and things are getting to be a little more unpredictable, and then I actually have to start using my calendar again to figure out what's going on. But, you know, when I was thinking about those friends, I was thinking the friends that we have here, the friends that are showing up here at the Zendo, are different kinds of friends than the friends we usually talk about. And it includes the friends we usually talk about, but the friends here that we practice with are a different kind of friend. They're a special kind of friend. And I realize when I say that, I don't want to make it sound like it's a better kind of friend. So I don't want to make that kind of distinction. But it's a different kind of friend. It's a different kind of friendship than we normally might share with others. We're a sangha. Right? And that's why I said I want to sort of look at what that term means. Now, sangha is one of those terms. It's one of the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and sangha. And on a recent talk, might have even been my last one, I defined those terms pretty quickly. I said, Buddha is truth or reality, Dharma is the teaching, and Sangha is the community of people who are taking up this way, who are devoted to taking up this way. And then I said that, and I said, actually, that just skims the surface, because you could say much more about each of those terms and how they interrelate to one another. And at that time I said, but good enough for the purposes of that talk. And I'm going to say good enough for the purposes of this talk, except Sangha. Sangha I'm going to look at a little bit more closely. So again, the way that I define Sangha, just in my short definition, is a community devoted to taking up this way. And like I said, it doesn't quite get at it, but it certainly does give a quick pencil sketch of what Sangha is. Thich Nhat Hanh deepens it a little bit in a sketch that's only a little bit more complex. We might say he's using a pen brush. I just got a pen brush recently, and I'm an inveterate doodler, and now I have this new tool with which I can doodle, and it's been a lot of fun. So Thich Nhat Hanh maybe is using a pen brush to sketch out his Sangha. He says, Sangha is the fourfold community of monks, nuns, laymen, and lay women, as well as the other elements that support our practice. Our cushion, our walking meditation path, the trees, the sky, and the flowers. And so you can see Thich Nhat Hanh already opening up just this, my original definition, a community devoted to taking up this way. Thich Nhat Hanh's definition starts out that way, but then he opens it up to remind us that it's not just, we would think of the people who are here, but when we're thinking of the space, it's also our cushions. When I teach meditation instruction, which again has been 16 months or longer ago that I did that, but when I did that, one of the things I would tell people is that when we enter the Zendo, the meditation hall, we go to our cushion and we bow to it. We greet our cushion. And I said, in one way, we're just saying hi to our cushion. I mean, nothing wrong with that. Hi, cushion. And we're showing it some respect. Thank you for being here to support me while I meditate. And at the same time, we're greeting the entire universe. Because as we take up this practice, maybe not right away you don't see it, but as you start to take up this practice, you realize that cushion's not just that cushion. You start to see all that shows up as that cushion. The plant that grew, the cotton that grew to make the casing, the kapok that grew to make the stuffing, or the buckwheat, depending. The people who took care of the plants. I mean, I can go on and on. We can understand. When I teach meditation instruction, I do go on a bit longer. But you've heard me talk about this before, and I think it's a familiar exercise where you start to open up and realize that the things that are showing up before you aren't just the things that are showing up before you. That's just what's appearing right now. But what's actually showing up is the whole universe showing up as that cushion. So when we bow to the cushion, we're bowing to the whole universe. So Thich Nhat Hanh starts to show us that in his sketch of Sangha. He says, not just the people who are sitting here and coming together, it's also the cushion. It's also the meditation, walking meditation path, or here, the floor of this Zendo, which is so exquisite to walk on as it kind of gives in certain areas. I mean, there's something just pleasing about that to me. The sounds it makes as you're walking through the Zendo. But then he opens it up even further. It's the trees and the flowers. Because as I was saying, when we really settle down into this moment, we see that all of that is showing up. All of that is our practice. It really took me a little while to realize just how much was going into my practice when I was sitting Sesshin for a number of times. Then I started to realize that every time I sat Sesshin, my spouse was still at home and had to take care of things by himself. Not a big deal. Sessions last about a weekend. But there's that separation. There are, you know, if something's going to happen at home, say the time that we were standing in the kitchen and water just started pouring out from under our dishwasher. And good thing we were standing there when it happened, right? But if something like that's going to happen, he's going to have to take care of it. And he's responsible. He's actually helping take care of my Sesshin practice. He's actually practicing Sesshin with me while I'm sitting here. And that really struck me. He practices along with me. So Thich Nhat Hanh then opens up in that little sketch that he gives. There's a definition that Katagiri gives of Sangha that's even more spacious. Katagiri says that Sangha is the group of people who make the universe and its teaching alive in their lives. That really strikes me. It's the group of people who make the universe and its teachings alive in their lives. And in doing that, what Thich Nhat Hanh was pointing out about the trees and the flowers, that's all there. What I like about Katagiri's definition is it doesn't limit it to any kind of sect or any kind of religion. And people who are doing this, who are making the universe and its teachings alive in their lives, that's Sangha, that's that group of people. And you can be far-flung because you realize that you're not exactly far-flung, which again is what I think I experienced as we were broadcasting solely through Zoom and was touched to see people who I'd never heard of before, some people who I'd heard of before but hadn't seen in a while, and of course people that I saw regularly at Dharma Field. So Katagiri goes on then, and he talks a little bit more about Sangha. He says, Sangha is a community, but it's not the usual sense of community, because this community has many people who try to follow the Buddha's way. So they're excellent friends for you. And there's that word, friends. That was the first time I encountered it. And I think I had remembered Katagiri talked about friends. Because I remembered again how much that struck me, that there was a truth to it. And he calls them excellent friends. It's not community in the usual sense, because this community has many people who try to follow the Buddha's way, so they are excellent friends for you. I don't know if you've tried talking about Buddhist practice to friends and relatives who don't do this, but it's really a fool's game. You know, I've tried doing it, and I just, whenever I say something, it's not right anyhow. So then I have to correct what I just got done saying, and then I have to correct what I just corrected, and then they might start debating something that I just said, and I'm just like, why am I having this conversation? Of course, it's not necessary for us to have that talk. We don't have to do that. We can actually share our practice with people who don't know this practice, just in what we do and how we say things and how we take up our life. So we don't have to say a word. But if you've ever tried to do it, you know it's kind of a challenge. So when we practice with people who know these teachings, there's a shorthand in a way. There's a way of communicating that is the way we actually all communicate, which is this immediate, direct communication. It doesn't require all the blah, blah, blah. As I say this, and I'm going to give I don't know how long of a talk, but I'll try not to make it too long. I was looking at the page numbers, and I went, this could be a long one, so I'll try to. Could you spin that around for me, Bruce, just so I can curtail? Okay, so far so good. So we have people here who do have some understanding and are actually engaging in the same practice that we're engaging in, which is just, well, the way that Katagiri puts it, right? It's making the universe and its teaching alive in our lives. And that might seem like a big thing, but it's simply, how do you fluff your cushion? Are you paying attention when you step into the room? Are you listening to what? And are you lost in your thoughts and your feelings? Thich Nhat Hanh talks about Sangha as well, as you might imagine. He seems like a teacher who would talk about that. He says, in my country, we say that when a tiger leaves his mountain and goes to the lowlands, he will be caught by humans and killed. When a practitioner leaves her Sangha, She may abandon her practice and die as a practitioner. Practicing with the Sangha is essential. Even if we have a deep appreciation for the practice, it can be difficult to continue without the support of friends. You know, so again, when you're doing this flying solo, easy for that practice to die. And I'll talk about why in a moment. But this teaching seemed to me to be a very nicely put. You know, it helps us see how it is that Sangha is this, you know, interconnection where everyone is supporting each other's practice. Just showing up is not just you taking care of your own practice, but in doing that, you're taking care of the practice of others. It's another thing I point out in meditation instruction. One of the things you start to realize, well, I could tell you what happened when I first came to a meditation hall. All I thought about was everything I was doing wrong. Right? So I came in and I was like, oh no, did I just step in with the right foot? And my legs are going numb. And then I was like, well, I'm not supposed to move right now, but I think I'm not going to be able to stand up for the kin-in afterwards. And then I really have to swallow right now. I think if I do that, I'm going to disturb everybody. And then I would really need to swallow when I was doing that. So finally, I get to the point where I would just swallow, but I'd have to swallow several times because it was such an arduous task that I'd made for myself. All that was happening there was compassion. It didn't sound like it. It showed up in a pretty crazy way. But I realized that what I was doing was I was concerned about taking care of this space. I was concerned about taking care of others' meditation practice. That is what Sangha is. That's why if you leave your Sangha, you may end up killing your practice. There's not that same kind of support. There's not that same kind of sense of taking care of others in taking care of your practice when you're by yourself. Much easier to get sloppy. Much easier to do what I did again when I was a first practitioner and set my clock. Well, I didn't set my clock, but I'd say, okay, I'm sitting for 20 minutes. And then at minute 17, go, good enough. And just get up and leave. Not knowing at that time that right there at good enough, that's where the practice really starts. Right there when I can't sit another minute, that's where the practice starts. And again, when you're sitting with others, you don't just get up and walk out of the room. Maybe you do. But if you're really paying attention, you don't, because nobody else is doing that. And you know that if you do that, you'll disrupt the Sangha. You'll disrupt the collectedness of the room. And so you don't. So why is it so easy for us to get caught up? Well, that's what I'm pointing out, is we can easily get self-centered when we're by ourselves and start thinking about our own comfort and discomfort, particularly discomfort. I think most of us, well, now granted, if you're really relaxing, I'm a bit too often, I guess, will be enjoying something and then have to articulate it like, wow, this is really a beautiful evening. You know, completely unnecessary. So I do that. But I think when we're uncomfortable, there's just more of a tendency to want to do something about it. You know, because we're uncomfortable. And I remember in a study group here at Dharma Field, one of the students in the study group pointed that out. She said, look at how much of your life is spent making yourself comfortable, trying to avoid pain, just in every moment. And it was something I had just read in books by Joko Beck as well, the great Zen master. You know, she pointed out that same thing, how much of your life is spent trying to adjust our bodies or do whatever it is in order to make ourselves more comfortable or to avoid pain. What happens there is you can start to see we're getting self-centered in a way that when we're with Sangha, we're not. When with Sangha, we start to do what actually comes very naturally to us, which is to take care of others. When we're alone, we do that thing that also comes very naturally to us, which is take care of, indulge ourselves. We lose perspective. We get caught up in the drama of our lives. I think about when I went to graduate school. So I was studying English, And that's not like studying grammar. It's studying literature, English literature, American literature, and then studying literary theory. God help us. We studied literary theory and literature and maybe a little bit of the other stuff because we had to teach English. Though they kept telling us, you know, teaching composition, you don't need to know grammar or anything like that, which I think is true, but that's neither here nor there. But anyhow, when there I am in the English department, and suddenly there are gods walking among us, right? There's a hierarchy. There are the people who are like the chaired professors. And the chaired professors, they're the, you know, you want to get in one of their seminars. Not just chaired professors, but this is the guy right here. This is the guy who coined the term postmodernism when talking about literature. I could take a seminar with that guy. Woo, you know. Now, I'm talking to a room full of people where most of you are probably going, blah, do, post, blah, blah, I don't even know what he's talking about. Or, who cares? Right? But when you're in that environment, suddenly it matters. And suddenly that whole world of English studies, there are stars. There are people who you really want to meet, be in their presence, and hear their ideas, read their books. And yet when I would get outside of English world, and I talked to my friends about what I was doing in graduate school, it was actually worse than talking about Buddhism. Because I didn't, you know, I made the mistake of being an academic, and I'd try to explain what I was doing, and I could just see the eyes get glassy. You know, they'd be like, oh no, bail, get out of here. So we can lose perspective very easily. We get caught up in the little patch of our world that is showing up in front of us, right? That appears to us. The little circle of land, so to speak. You know, in the Genjo Koan, Dogen talks about how we can go out in the ocean and the ocean dust seems to be a circle. And I like that. You know, you just look around, it's what you can see, that's your world. And you understand it in a particular way and you respond to it in a particular way. And all of that stuff matters so much to nobody other than you and maybe a handful of other people. So it's real easy to lose our perspective, to get caught up in ego, ours. We think others, yeah, that professor's really got an ego. I remember somebody posted a poster. Now, this gentleman has passed away, but he would not mind my sharing this because of his response when this happened, but one of the chaired professors, somebody, he was not a guy that everybody liked. I happened to idolize him almost, and was kind of a problem, but other people hated him. And so there was a sign posted in our office, like the area where every English instructor, all the professors would go. It said, who is Herb Blau and why does he think that he gets to say what this department does? Wow, okay, something was going on there, right? And I remember Herb saying, well, he goes, I'm from showbiz. All publicity is good publicity. Though he did remove the signs as well. But we get caught up in that so easily. Katagiri puts it this way. What we do is we forget our Buddha nature. He says, if we forget our Buddha nature, we become just an ordinary human being. The reason we forget is simple. We don't understand that we are Buddha. But the meaning of we are Buddha goes beyond whether we understand or not. We are exactly Buddha. So that's what we do. We lose track of that. Whatever term we put there, if we're not prone to say, you are Buddha. But again, that's why with these excellent friends, we know what that means, or I shouldn't say we know what that means, but we've heard that before. To hear that isn't so startling as it would be if I were to just go over to a friend's house and go, you know, Lisa, you are Buddha. I'm sure she'd take umbrage with that. But we all know what that's pointing to. That sense of we're not just the little self that we sometimes limit ourselves to believing we are. I remember Cal Appleby. longtime friend, a Dharma Field friend of mine, friend of many people here who just passed away recently. And I remember when he would go to Stillwater, he would say to the people there, be the being that you are. He would say, I know you can be the being you are. And that's what we're here for. So you can be the being that you truly are. Not the one that we think we are, the one that society tells us we are, but the being that we truly are. So we all realize it, but we forget it. We forget it all the time. We just lose track of that. Katagiri goes on, he says, being Buddha means the total qualification for living in this world under all circumstances. You are qualified to be here under all circumstances. And then he says something interesting. There are no excuses. That's not what you would expect to be next. But he really means it. There are no excuses. You are qualified to be here. No excuses. Here you are. You are supposed to be here. Now what? He continues, we have to respect each other and all sentient beings. But when we forget our Buddha nature, we do not have a chance to communicate the spirit of the universe. This is really a senseless way to be a human being. If we are mindful that we are Buddha, it is really the driving force that gives life to our everyday activity. That's realizing universe in our lives, in our daily lives. To realize that. When we forget that, we start living as if we're not Buddha. We start living as if that little territory, that circle, is all there is. And what we think about the circle and our feelings about that circle, that that's truth, that that has some kind of solidity and weight to it, that somebody outside of that circle will have no idea what we're talking about or why we're so invested in it. It's actually why I think sometimes it's easy for friends to talk us off a ledge. We've gotten ourselves so worked up. There we are. And they just come in and they go, it's not a big deal. Just scrape off the black part of the egg and put it back in the oven with aluminum on it. I say that because when I was Tenzo, I burnt the eggs downstairs and I went into a full-blown panic attack. And luckily my spouse was there. So he just said, not a big deal. We can just scrape the black off. Not a big deal. We'll just put some aluminum on there, put it back in the oven. Whew, thank God. So Sangha then helps us to not get caught up in those limited views. And Thich Nhat Hanh continues, he says, building a Sangha, supporting a Sangha, being with a Sangha, receiving support and guidance of a Sangha is the practice. We have individual eyes and Sangha eyes. When a Sangha shines its light on our personal views, we see more clearly. In the Sangha, we won't fall into negative habit patterns. Stick to your Sangha. Take refuge in the Sangha, and you'll have the wisdom and support you need. So I like that. We have our individual eyes and our Sangha eyes. And that's what I was pointing out. Individual eyes just see things from our own stick yard. Right? We're measuring things with our own stick yard, as Katagiri used to say, our own yardstick. Then we have Sangha eyes. Sangha eyes, we don't fall into negative habit patterns. Interesting way to put it. We don't fall into negative habit patterns. We know what those are. And of course we say, but I do that all the time. I guess maybe I'm not a Sangha member. But think about again what the practice is. We're practicing together in every moment, realizing universe in every moment. So that's what we do. We just remember we're Buddha. Remember you are Buddha. Remember that now. So, okay, you fall into a negative habit pattern, right? You're still Buddha. You are Buddha. Now you have step into the next moment. Step into the next moment. Step into the next moment. Sangha helps us to see when we're getting caught up in our limited views. As I said, when I first came here, for me, that showed up as me being totally self-conscious. But think about that. Self-conscious. How was I living my life? Undoubtedly, I was doing that out there, you know, out there, just meaning I'm just pointing outside of this hall, but really, anywhere I go, I'm carrying that around with me, that self-consciousness. That's what self-consciousness is. I'm just way aware of that self, and I'm trying to keep it from looking like an idiot, or keep it from being hurt, or keep it from suffering some more. So I have some compassion for that, even though it drives me crazy. I don't like being self-conscious. I don't like, you know, dropping something because I'm thinking about it too hard. I don't like doing that. But there's something sweet about that too, because I know that again, that self-consciousness is an awareness of the fact that I'm not really just that self that I think I am. It's awareness. It's starting to see with Sangha eyes. It's starting to see outside of myself. So I encountered another story that I want to share with you. It's one that Okamura tells us. It's kind of similar to Thich Nhat Hanh's story about the tiger, except this one is one you may have heard of before. And Okamura has a nice little discussion about this story afterwards. It's about Guishan, the great Zen master, student of Baizheng. That's an encounter, actually, between Baizheng and Guishan. Okamura writes that Guishan was Tenzo, the chief cook, in the monastery where he practiced with his teacher, Baizheng. One day, Guishan was standing near the abbot's room where Baizheng was staying, Baizheng asked Guishan, "Who is it?" Guishan replied, "It's me, Ling Yu," which was Guishan's Dharma name. Baizheng said, "Would you dig in the fire pot and see if there is a fire or not?" It was winter, and the fire pot was their source of heat. Guishan stirred the fire pot and said, "No fire." Then Baizheng got up and came over, dug deep into the ashes, and found a tiny ember. He showed it to Ling Yu and said, "What is this? Isn't this fire?" Guishan was enlightened. Okamura's commentary. Okamura says, the fire in the story refers to the Buddha nature. Buddha nature is not something solid or immovable, but rather an energy that motivates us to practice, and not just Zazen or Buddhist practice. Buddha nature is the fire of the life force that enables us to aspire to be better persons, to be more helpful to others, to settle into a healthy way of life, and to practice the way. It's difficult to find the fire of Buddha nature inside ourselves, but we must. It's there. We are alive, so we have this force that drives us to practice and wake up to the reality of life. It may only be an ember, but all of us, without exception, have it. Right? That ember, you are Buddha. All of us, without exception, have it. When we practice with other people, we gather together small fires. If we try to build a fire in a hibachi or fire pot with a single piece of charcoal, it soon dies out. But even one tiny ember, if fed with charcoal, becomes a big fire. This is the meaning of Sangha. We practice together with other people in a Sangha. Each one of us has a small fire, which alone will die out sooner or later. Together, we become bigger than ourselves. This was Guishan Lingyu's enlightenment. So again, when we sit with others, and we all have that fire, we're all Buddha, but when we come together, that fire lives. And when we live alone, which we never are, but we can certainly live as if we are, that fire can easily die out. When we practice with others, we have Sangha eyes. When you just sit meditation in a room, you know the people you're sitting with in a way that you don't know them talking to them. It's a very different experience. I remember Bo gave a talk, it was a number of years ago, and he was talking about, might have been Sashin, and he was talking about how intimately you get to know one another in a Sashin, and you don't talk. You just finally settle down, and you have Sangha eyes. You stop just paying attention to the world according to your own needs, according to their own screen. You actually get to know, I remember Bo pointed out, how somebody turned a corner. You get to know how that person turns a corner. You see that. You know that. You sit next to them when they're uncomfortable. You feel their discomfort. You're with them when they're nodding off. Maybe you're on a little polyphonic moment where they nod off, they wake up, you nod off, you wake up, they nod off. Just like that. But you really get to know one another just in that presence. That's that sharing, that ember, sharing that Buddha nature. Not ideas about what's showing up, but just what it is that's showing up, being in tune with it. And those are our good friends that share those experiences with us. Really genuinely are sharing Buddha nature with us, just as we're sharing Buddha nature. So Katagiri actually defines good friend. So I thought I'd share with you his definition of good friend. He's got three of them. He says there, good friend has three meanings. One is our usual sense of a good friend. He says that's someone who benefits us in some way. Good conversation, somebody who makes us feel good, somebody maybe we trust, we can share things with. Maybe somebody who, one of my good friends, actually a lot of my good friends are good cooks. It's always a happy moment when I'm invited over for dinner because I know it's going to be good. So it's somebody that benefits us in some way. Then another good friend, he tells us, is someone who commands respect beyond a sense of give and take. Katagiri says, even though this person cannot give material things or anything of practical benefit to others, one can deeply respect this person. And I think we all know people like that. We respect them. We may not even have a personal relationship with them, but we know them somehow. And we respect them. And they are not giving us a darn thing. But we still have that deep sense of respect. Then there's the third sense of good friend. Katagiri says that sense of good friend is completely beyond either a sense of respect or give and take. Even though this person lives far away or she always influences our life in a broad sense. Even if we think of this person for just a moment, the presence of this person really helps our life. It's not merely our imagination. This third good friend is always helping us in many ways. That good friend seems to be a little bit harder to pin down, a little bit harder to say who this person is. Sounds to me like we're talking about reality. Reality is our good friend. That doesn't matter near or far. It's always near, but our sense about whether or not it's near or far. It's always just thinking of that, being in the presence of that helps our life. For this good friend that Katagiri is talking about, the universe and its teaching is alive. The universe and its teaching is alive. So we don't reduce them to our usual sense of what makes a good friend. Those evaluations, not as important. So Katagiri then says about Sangha. So you see, the community we call Sangha is quite different from the usual sense of community. In the usual sense, people just gather and live together. But in the Sangha, each person has to be an excellent friend to all the others. Because we must be following Buddhist teaching, we must be following the essence, the virtue, the functioning of the universe, and therefore we become an excellent friend to others. Usually it is difficult to act in this way. This is why in communities in the United States, there are lots of problems. Most people think Sangha is just a usual community. This is understandable because the people who practice in the community are no different from other people. All of us are just human beings. This is true. We are human beings, but at the same time, we are not human beings. We are Buddha. Don't forget this point. That Sangha is not to forget this point. Sangha, then, is what we do. It's not a thing. So it's not a thing you join. You do Sangha by making the universe and its teaching alive in every moment. As I said when I was describing what that could look like, it looks like this. It looks like what's showing up. This is Sangha. And like I said, over the past year, what Sangha is struggled with a little bit. We are on the computers. And I had a sense of community there. But it was probably more a community of the first sort that Katagiri talks about. The good friends in the usual sense of some give and take. Perhaps even a little bit of the second one, someone who commands respect beyond a sense of give and take. But Sangha is really that third sense of a friend that's completely beyond either a sense of respect or a give and take. Sangha is what we do. We realize universe together. It's actually the only way it can be done. When you realize that, or when it's realized, you can see that. When you don't realize it, you don't realize it. It seems like this is something that we have to do on our own. Struggle with it. It's really hard. And it may be somehow, I don't know, something clicks, you know. But it's the only way we can do it is together. Sangha is not falling into negative habit patterns, to paraphrase Thich Nhat Hanh. It's just about collecting the mind, settling the mind, being here, realizing universe. And I thought that talking about a settled mind, I'm taking this cue from Jed Larson, who said, maybe you want to talk about settling the mind before you talk about our COVID plan. So while I'm talking about a settled mind, I just wanted to really quickly talk about our COVID plan to end my talk. The COVID plan that we have? Yeah. COVID. Quite all right. I switched gears so fast there. But I have it. You'll see. I'm coming back to Sangha at the end of this. So I think I mentioned this in the email, but we tried to come up with a COVID plan that we felt wasn't restrictive, or at least wasn't too restrictive, while being mindful of the safety of the Sangha, and also one that called for personal responsibility, because that's our practice. That's what I was just talking about, right? About the fact that Sangha is realizing universe in each moment. So we're responsible for that. We're responsible to take care of Sangha. That's Sangha, is taking care of Sangha, is seeing that we're not individuals. So first of all, I just wanted to make that note. I also want to let you know that it's a work in progress. So if there are things about it where you go, that's really screwy that you're doing this, please let me know that. We would be more than happy to hear your feedback on this. Michael Cody put it a nice way. He said, think of it as a dance. He goes, two step forwards, one step back. Two step forwards, one step back. Cha-cha-cha, cha-cha-cha. You're doing the cha-cha-cha. So it's a work in progress. We're going to continue to adjust it, both according to the COVID situation, and I'm sure you know there's still news about COVID going on out there, the Delta variant. I have a friend who just moved to Missouri a couple months ago. So I wrote him to see, how you doing? How are things going? And he's pretty much doing there what he was doing in Minnesota last year. So, but we know that there's situations we have to keep our eyes on, and we'll adjust the plan accordingly, and we'll share that with you. And we'll also adjust it according to feedback from our Sangha. We'll confer first, so it won't be every time we get a bit of feedback we change the plan, but we'll confer and adjust the plan accordingly. I also want to remind you it's a partial reopening. And what I mean by that is you'll see mainly all of our sittings are back. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we just have one evening sitting now, just to accommodate the classes. But we have no teach retreat, though we are going to invite people to stay and socialize after the talk. I'm going to invite you to go outside, stand in the shade, and if that ends up being too hellish, we can work out another solution. But I invite you to join us out there. Unfortunately, the board members are going to have to dodge out after a little bit, so forgive them in advance. Also, there are no sessions currently scheduled through the end of 2021. They were just a little uncomfortable doing sessions yet. It's very intimate. You sit with people for a long time, and if you stay at Dharma Field during the session, which is recommended because it really keeps you in the practice, now you're sleeping with other people as well, you know, in the same room with other people. And so we just want to be cautious about that. Be safe. So right now we're putting that on hold, though our plan is to schedule some extended zazens in the fall. That won't be quite as intense as a session. So we'll let you know about that. I also want to talk about our face mask and social distancing policy. Just a reminder, we're asking that if you're vaccinated, masks are optional, right? So weigh that for yourself. If you're uncomfortable not wearing a mask, by all means, wear a mask. You know, don't feel pressured to go without a mask. And maybe you feel pressured that way because you might feel that if you put on a mask, people are going to think you're unvaccinated and then you're going to get an earful. Mary.
Yeah, I was concerned that because I'm wearing a mask,
right,
people think I'm unvaccinated.
Right.
I'm not. Yeah. I'm vaccinated.
That was one of my points. We're going to ask that you, I know people have strong ideas about masks, wearing them or not wearing them. So if you see someone wearing a mask, don't make an assumption. I'm wearing a mask except when I talk. Steve Hagen is wearing a mask. We're both vaccinated. Jed Larson is wearing a mask. He's vaccinated. There are probably others here as well. I don't want to out anybody or, you know, whatever. But so don't make any assumptions. But again, we do ask that if you are unvaccinated, we request that you should wear a mask and social distance. I know people have strong feelings about this because I've heard them. So I know there are very strong feelings. Right now isn't the place to get into them. I'm happy to talk with you about this stuff. But what I'm going to ask is, when you're at Dharma Field, this has to do with settling the mind of the community. So just ask you to look at what is the community practice. So again, this is looking with Sangha eye. When you sit meditation, one of the things we ask is you don't wear distracting clothing. I do remember for a while there was a practitioner who wore hot pink sweatpants that said pink right on the butt. You know, a little distracting. Kind of grabs your eye. You know, we're trying to loosen the grip we have on objectifying the world in this space. So we usually ask people don't wear anything too flashy that's going to catch people's eyes. It's only for that reason, you know, is that otherwise we're right there doing business as usual. But again, think about how you take care of the room normally, how you're concerned about moving and making noise and all kinds of things. And so you don't. Same thing with wearing masks. Just follow the community standard. That's all we ask. Whether or not you agree with why we're doing it, at this point doesn't matter so much. I ask that you look at that, because that is what Steve points out to us. That's your mind leaning. And he reminds us, look to your own mind. So look to your own mind and just ask to trust your heart, trust what you're observing, and follow that. Look at the Sangha. Steve reminded me that Katagiri shared with his students a great Zen teaching. He said, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Which I think I first heard sung by that great Zen master, Tony Bennett. So just think of wearing the mask if you're unvaccinated as taking care of the room, of helping settle the room. Now, granted, people aren't going to know whether you're vaccinated or not. So again, this is just asking you to take care of this, to take some personal responsibility. It's like the Tenzo in the story that Dogen tells, who's drying the mushrooms in the hot sun. And Dogen says, you could do this some other time, you know. And the teacher says, really, if not now, when? And then Dogen says, well, you could have your students do this. And the teacher, or the Tenzo says, who was a teacher, a profound teacher in what he said. He said, if I don't do it, who will? Right? Take personal responsibility and just do, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. That is practicing Sangha. So, with that in mind, the COVID plan, thinking of that as practice, and thinking of everything I've said about Sangha, that Sangha is practice, I wanted to end on this note and just invite you. Let's Sangha together. And I actually did leave time. So if people have questions or comments, I'm happy to take them at this time. Yeah, Mary.
Where did you get the comments on Sangha from Kadhiri? What is that from?
That's from Returning to Silence and his chapter on the Triple Treasure.
Okay, thank you.
Is there a question there? Oh, good, we do have Zoom questions. Yeah.
Yeah, just to let you know, we had a... Sorry, I forgot to do this. We had 42 people join us today.
Huh?
Online.
Great. Thank you. Nice. I wish I could see you right now. Maybe we'll be working that, but nice to at least see the HAL 9000 eye there pointing at me. Thanks for sharing, Jose. Yeah.
When Jose or someone online makes a comment, you may want to repeat that so that the people online can actually hear what was said. I don't think that Jose has done work.
So, I'm sorry I can't say that.
Just repeat what Jose says so that the people online can hear.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. What Jose said was there were 42 people who joined us. I'm guessing that you probably could see that, but, you know, just in case. I think it's great. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's in my iPhone.
Yeah. So like I said, our Sangha that joins us via Zoom, this is a work in progress, so we will figure out how to do this. And again, that's where feedback from the Sangha can be very helpful. If there are people who use this stuff, you know, I feel like I'm one of those people who, Steve, I'm going to call you out on this just because I think it's so ingenious, but the way that Steve mutes his videos, he just puts a post-it note over his camera lens. You know, it's very low tech, and that's kind of my approach to Zoom. Post-it notes and just a little bit of redirection. So we're going to keep working on it, but thanks for sharing that, Jose. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Mike.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your talk, especially the part about when you step off the path, just not beating up on yourself. And remember, you were Buddha, you gave me back on that. Because I had that happen this morning. I was looking forward to coming here, but I was also a little apprehensive, so I didn't get out of bed. And then I was beating up on myself, and I said, oh, the day's ruined, and my plan. And then I told myself, this is ridiculous, you know? Just step back into the moment and take care of things.
Yeah, because think about how endless that is, Mike.
Yeah.
So first you step off the path or whatever, and then you go, oh, I can't, I just ruined my day. Wait a minute, I shouldn't be telling myself that I just stepped off the path. I shouldn't beat myself up. Oh, no, I'm beating myself up about stepping on the path. And yeah, you can actually see again just in the endlessness of that, because it's endless. That that's not going to stop it. that at that moment, you can just, to me, it's like an old friend. You know, I just go, I know that guy. I know that guy. He's always here complaining about something or another, you know. Say hi, you know, and just let it be there. And you're right. But you can see that if you try to do something about it, or you think of it in terms of having done something wrong and you need to correct it, that's just endless.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, this was from, actually it's from the reading for Mary's class. Steve was saying, the chapter says, really lose our way, I think it was. Steve says, if you're stuck, just be stuck. But just realize that if you're present in this moment, there's nothing to see. And if you're not present, just come back. Don't think there's anything more to meditation than this.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, Mike, easier said than done sometimes.
Because
for me, I'm going 60 miles an hour before I realize I've stomped on the gas. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, this is a 20-mile-an-hour zone. Okay. Yeah, Mary.
I wanted to thank Bruce for being the Sunday morning one and for not closing the doors until I got up the stairs and into the Zendo. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I want to thank you as well, Bruce. Bruce is our new Sunday Doan, so thank you for stepping into that role. Thank you, Mary. All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.